You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, whether you call it a midlife crisis or fear that our best working days are behind us, there are a lot of emotions that can be wrapped up in our professional lives as we get older. Our guest shares lots of strategies on navigating this period in life happily and successfully. Now, the 18th State of the Tribes address just wrapped up in the Capitol earlier today. The annual speech started in 2005 as a way to recognize the intergovernment relationship between the Wisconsin government and the state's 11 federally recognized tribes. This year's address, delivered by President Shannon Holsey of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of the Mohican Nation, focused on things like climate change, K-12 education, representation of Native Americans and women in government, and more.
These initiatives are crucial because when tribes succeed, the state of Wisconsin succeeds.
We're talking now about the 2022 State of the Tribes address. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to this year's State of the Tribes address? What stood out to you? Are you a member of a Great Lakes tribe? What do you think is the biggest issue facing your community right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Richard L. Ackley is a retired judge of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Judge Ackley, welcome back to Central Time.
Yes, Rob, good afternoon. The last time we spoke was 2 years ago before the pandemic, and I drove out to UW Green Bay radio station.
That's right.
It's cloudy today, so good to hear your voice.
You too, and not a good day for driving, I think, today.
Correct.
Before we dig into this year's address, Judge Ackley, I know you are a fan, a connoisseur of State of the Tribes addresses. I think you have all the transcripts. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the State of the Tribes address, why it happens in Wisconsin every year?
In 2005, Speaker Gard and Ray DePerry, who was the former tribal chairman for Red Cliff in northern Wisconsin, got together and they found it important for the state of Wisconsin and the legislature to understand the sovereign nations of the tribe, but also to be reminded that tribal people are state citizens, tribal citizens, and federal citizens. And I must also state that we always include the Brotherton, which is a non-federally, non-recognized tribe. And that's important because in 2005, it listed 50,000 Native people. In the 2020 census, there's over 92,000, so it's almost been 100,000. So the population is growing, and it's important to understand that and to respect the government-to-government relationship.
What stood out to you about this year's address? It covered quite a bit of ground.
What stood out, and maybe it's because of my Native American worldview or philosophy, Native people, Indigenous people, think of collectiveness in generations, not that any one generation is great. So it tends to be more inclusive, but the dynamic today of this speech is to ensure the continuation of the relationship with the state of Wisconsin and its uniqueness of tribes. And what stood out is how the tribes handled the pandemic or the COVID. And what also stood out was the collective view, because the 11 tribes come together and they understand what they have to present, but at no time did I see any kind of sort of division amongst the tribes. I'm always surprised that the elected officials cannot just recognize a sovereign nation or also acknowledge the land that they're on. And all across the country now, tribes are doing, universities and other people are doing land acknowledgments, where you just acknowledge that the people were here first and the tribes were here. I mean, that's a historic fact.
President Holsey talked about that multi-generational view on a number of issues, including the environment and the environmental health of the Great Lakes region. Issues like climate change, pipelines, especially Enbridge Line 5, sustainable natural resources. Can you talk about some of what she had to say there and how she saw tribes maybe working with the state government on these issues?
Perhaps I would say, because I have a legalistic Indigenous background, that tribes have, in my role is one of neutrality, to have parties come together. But the difficulty the state of Wisconsin is going to have is that the state of Minnesota had the relationship with, to use the pipeline, for example, I believe they were misdemeanors. But with the state of Wisconsin, the legislature, in their wisdom or not in their wisdom, passed laws that they consider demonstrations a felony. Now, I don't know the complete details of that, but I would want people to come to the table or to be understand the issues. But I believe what's going to happen in Wisconsin, that the federal courts will perhaps, and the federal administrations will probably be more important, given the fact that the state is somewhat polarized because of a Republican-dominated legislature. And I respect the current governor and what he's trying to do, but I see Wisconsin and the tribes with that specific issue to be resolved in federal court.
Now, something that struck me was that President Holsey, in some cases, was looking for a common ground, I think, on some issues. She also went into some things that have a lot of partisan division on them here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country, including voting rights. And she raised concerns about efforts to change Wisconsin's voting laws. Were you surprised to see her go there?
No, I was not, because let's not forget that a tribal person is a state citizen, is a tribal citizen, and a federal citizen. And all we're asking for, at least I believe in the legalistic system, is tribes have a right to vote. Now, I'm a member of a tribe where we allow absentee voting. Across the country, other tribes have different formats of voting, but what I believe in is transparency. And I don't believe partisanship should enter the access to vote.
We're talking to Richard L. Ackley, retired judge of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. We're looking at issues raised in today's State of the Tribes address delivered earlier today at the state capitol by President Shannon Holsey of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of the Mohican Nation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the address, if you watched or listened, your questions about it, about the role of the State of the Tribes address, your thoughts on particular issues raised in it, including oil pipelines, a lot of court cases coming on that for sure, investments in education, Native American mascot issues, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I just mentioned education. President Holsey called for more investment in K-12 education and looking at the history of Native Americans and their interaction with state and federal governments.
The impact of these actions authorized by the United States government upon Native American people and cultures is something that we will never truly make whole. But there must be a willingness to teach a balanced account of U.S. history that incorporates accurate, comprehensive, and relevant curriculum in Native American history and culture.
Judge Ackley, a lot of controversy about the way issues of American history and race are taught in schools. What did you think of what President Holsey had to say there?
I would personally endorse her strategy or her assessment. One of the interesting dynamics of this country, the United States of America, is they don't recognize there are 574 tribes. In the most recent census, 2020, we have over 6.7 million people. And unless the European person becomes aware of their Euro-American dynamic, tribes have a right to their own cultural immersion with language. They also have a right, the new generations, each generation has a better understanding of how to deal with these issues. I have a daughter who's a professor out in the state of Washington. What they study, the reason why I share that is I went to New Zealand, and the Maori people in New Zealand, they're connected within that country. I mean, that's really their country. But the difficulty we're having is partisanship ought not to take place in education. It ought not to take place in the universities, the dynamics that are taking place. I believe the newer generations are pretty knowledgeable how to engage and have a better understanding of the diversity of tribes across this country.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I may be a little nervous on this, but I believe that Shannon should run for governor. I really like what she was saying.
Well, Tom, thanks. So Tom listened to the speech, impressed by President Holsey there. And actually, that reminds me, Richard, Shannon Holsey talked about the need for Native Americans and women in particular. She made the case to be involved in the political system around the state. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, and I'm going to be really careful about this to the gentleman in Milwaukee. As a person who respects all genders, I believe that Shannon is comfortable enough in her leadership role within her tribe. I think too often citizens across the state don't recognize that you can articulate yourself as a federal citizen, you can articulate yourself as a state citizen, you can articulate yourself as a tribal citizen. So in some ways, she represents, and I believe the inclusiveness, elders are important in tribal communities, people of middle age are important in tribal communities. The more we can see that, that is what we're all about. But I believe her role today was to make some attempt to educate the legislators. And I can always tell because I watched it in a video. I have all the copies of all the State of the Tribe addresses. I've reviewed most of the videos. And to me, it would be nice if the both parties could just put aside and say, we'll find a way to work in cooperation with the Wisconsin tribes because they want to respect the government-to-government relationship. And over the years, that's been honored. But to me, tribal work ought not to be factionized. In other words, the state legislature has an opportunity to benefit from that. And as much as I listened later, there were two elders, World War II, this is not to criticize Speaker Voss, he said, the greatest generation in the Native community, the greatest is all generations. So that's the theme, I think, of Shannon's. We're inclusive, but we have to make connections to every generation.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about today's 18th Annual State of the Tribes Address. Richard Ackley is with us, retired judge of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think tribal groups in Wisconsin and the Wisconsin state government can work together better? Were there particular issues raised in the State of the Tribes address you want to see more focus on, ask about, share your thoughts on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the 2022 State of the Tribes address delivered earlier today by President Shannon Holsey of the Stockbridge-Munsee Band of the Mohican Nation. Here's a part of how President Holsey wrapped up her speech.
It is said that if you are not hungry for justice, equity, and inclusion, it is perhaps because you are too full of privilege.
Richard Ackley stays with us. He's a retired judge of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. You can join in with your questions about the speech, about some of the issues, the many issues raised in it, your reactions if you watched or listened at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on. The question I have is there's such strong lobbyist groups that have many politicians in their pockets. And is there a lobbyist group for the Native American? And if there is, how strong is it?
Richard, thanks for the call. Are there lobbying operations for Native American, for tribal nations at the state or federal level?
I would personally say the lobbyist is a secondary issue to the issue of the affirmation of a government-to-government relationship. And the other issue is tribes have a strong relationship with the federal government, and they have a strong relationship based upon treaties. And also, lobbying is a context of trying to persuade a specific issue. And I believe each tribe in their own delivery will lobby whatever they choose to. But what I was impressed with today was that Shannon mentioned a series of bills that have benefit to the tribes. And to me, that's a form of being inclusive in the lobbying. I was just in Two Rivers on Sunday for a memorial service of a young 15-year-old boy who drowned at the high school. But the context here is we are live in a state where we need to understand that lobbying is not the specific answer. What the answer is, how do we respect the government-to-government relationship?
Richard, thanks for the call. Louis joins us next in Oconto. Louis, hello.
Yeah, excuse me. I was really touched when they talked about the Line 5 and how there's really not a lot of conversation between the government in Madison and how it's going to affect the tribes and everybody that uses northern Wisconsin.
Louis, thanks for the call. Line 5, a big issue, and President Holsey spent some time on that, Judge Ackley.
Yeah, and since I'm a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and I believe in total transparency, as I said to you, in my role as a tribal judge, I served in a neutrality position. But as I stated, I believe that, and it was well defined, that this issue is going to either be solved by the federal court, because the difficulty we have, different than the state of Minnesota, where demonstrators, I think it's a misdemeanor, but in the state of Wisconsin, if I understand the legislature, they have demonstrators through the effect of lobbying. It's a felony. So it's difficult for me to understand how, as the gentleman from Oconto states, how this is going to be resolved, given the fact it's a federal, it's also the company is from Canada. Some things have to be taken, resolved, but I see, maybe it's my legalistic indigenous dynamic, I see it to be solved within the federal court system.
Thanks for that call. Judge Ackley, in the address we heard about Native American images used as mascots in schools, and President Holsey really laid out the personal impact that might have, not just on students, but on other members of Native American communities. Can you talk about what we heard there?
I would say because of the first address given in 2005, and I have all those, that was a major theme of Mr. Ray DePerry, former tribal chairman of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. And to me, I have come to see the Washington Redskins, now called the Commanders. To me, anytime you can change an image, you can change something that's disrespectful to a Native individual. To me, you start seeing us, or seeing the community tribal folks, as human beings, as which they are. But also what's helping in that, she did address that many of the tribes are doing cultural immersion programs with language, and they're doing many, many things, food sovereignty, education. So I am always hopeful, but I believe that I didn't know what was going to take place from 2005. And for me to see in 17 years all these changes at mascots, there's still some that have to be dealt with. But to me, that's a positive change.
Another theme that came up a couple times during the address was reminding people that Native Americans aren't just subjects of anthropological studies or distant figures in history. They're here now. How important is it to restate that in an address like this?
It is very important, because to me, as my former bishop in Oklahoma, I'm very active in the Episcopal Church, he said, if you're ignorant of being ignorant, you're still ignorant. And listening to the state legislature, I wouldn't mind having a one-on-one and do a survey with each legislator, no matter what party, and what do you know about the Native experience? I spent a lot of time knowing about the non-Native experience, and the Native world is so complex. The Native world views, the languages, the experience, the respect for creation. I can go on and on and on, but in our short time, this is where I see these state addresses bringing some awareness to the elected officials.
Another part of that awareness actually maybe came up in President Holsey's talk about economic diversity for tribal nations, and talking about cultural tourism opportunities. Can you talk? Is that something that you think is a good prospect for the future?
I would say cultural tourism is, but I think we have sort of missed, you know, in her address, if I look through the past, in the state of Wisconsin, the Oneida tribe owns a bank, and they have opened it to, you know, it's a small community bank. Up north, there's other, the Menominee tribe has their focus upon, you know, the sustainable cutting of trees, the basketball courts that have their type of wood species. To me, the economic vitality, tourism is one aspect. But as I would say, you have to be fully participating in the economy. I sort of think we missed something this year that should have been hyped more a little bit. The health departments of tribes and the COVID, that they were able to follow a very healthy, strict model to protect the young, the middle-aged, the older. And we didn't have the controversy over masks, the controversy over vaccinations. So that's a plus for tribal communities.
Judge Ackley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Take care. Peace.
It's Richard Ackley, retired judge of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. He talked to us about the 2022 State of the Tribes address, which took place earlier today. If you missed it, you can find it archived over at WPR.org. We'll have that full address up there, and you can find ones from past years as well. Now, this may come as a shock to some people, but we are not always in full control of our continued career success. What's that? We can't stay at the top of our games for as long as we want? No, our next guest says no matter how high your career peaks, they are that. They're peaks, heights, and they're going to be followed at some point by a decline. Well, that sounds kind of depressing, but it doesn't have to be if we're willing to change our mindset. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where are you in your career? How are you thinking about what's coming next? Have you made plans, or have you fulfilled a plan to have a next chapter after your career, whatever it might have been? Or are you trying to figure that out right now? Are you over 50 and trying to figure out what you want to do when you grow up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Arthur Brooks is William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at Harvard's Business School. He created the How to Build a Life column for The Atlantic. He's the author of a dozen books. His latest is called From Strength to Strength: Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Well, you did a lot of research in this book, but it started very personally for you. What got you started down this path?
You know, I've always thought, and, you know, I'm a social scientist and I specialize in the science of happiness, but I was making this one mistake, which is I thought that successful people, they tend to wind up happier than people who haven't done as much with their lives, that people who do big things, you know, they can kind of dine out on it and feel good about it for the rest of their life. But I had this experience some years ago. I was on a plane and I was overhearing a conversation of an elderly couple behind me. And the husband was confessing to his wife that he might as well be dead, that nobody loved him anymore. And that, you know, people had forgotten him and he was so depressed. And at the end of the flight, everybody stood up and I turned around to get a look. And it was one of the most famous men in the world, somebody who had accomplished 10 times what I will ever accomplish in my career in my wildest dreams. And it made it clear to me that people struggle. And, you know, the truth is that people struggle more when they've done a lot and those things are finished. I went on to do a little study of how people get happier as they get older. And I found that about half of people get happier and happier from 70 on, and the other half start going back down. And so I started this study to say, what are the habits of the people who get happier as they age? And what can we do to remarkably change the odds of being happier at 75 than we were at 25? And this book is the result. It's the 7 secrets, the 7 habits of what people who get happier in old age, what they all do in common. I think I may have cracked the code.
One recurring theme in the book seems to be the things that might make us successful in the eyes of our peers or of the public don't always line up with the things that make us happy, especially in that later in life era. Why is that?
Well, one of the problems that we have in life is that we're always getting addicted to things that give us momentary satisfaction, whether it's cigarettes or drugs and alcohol or gambling. And one of the things that people who are really hard workers, who are strivers, you know, they've been told by their parents that they're the special one, that they can always do something better than others, is they become what I call success addicts. Success means you're kind of getting the cookie for doing the right thing, for working harder, for getting the grades, for accomplishing. And people get into this pattern quite early in life, and they pursue it well into their adulthood, you know, success to success to success. And it's like being on a treadmill, actually. A little tiny bit of satisfaction, then it wears off, and then there we go again. It's a very dangerous addiction. It's not the secret to doing well. And when inevitably your skills change, I mean, you said in the introduction to the segment that our skills decline, and they do. The problem is that we won't let things decline. We won't let things change. That one of the great secrets to people who actually get happier is that their early skills do decline, but a new set of skills appear if we're willing to let things go. We can be more successful later in life than we ever were earlier in life, but we have to let things go and let ourselves change.
You mentioned 7 keys to finding that happiness later in life. We won't get to all of them today. I want to pick out one since I teased it a little bit there for people. The number one thing seems to be building good relationships. Easier said than done, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's easier for some people than it is for others. But once again, we're talking about people who work very hard and try to do a lot with their lives. A lot of people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, let's not kid ourselves, who are, you know, doing a lot and they have good values and they're really hard workers. But the result is that they make some sacrifices. I've been working with people and teaching at the Harvard Business School. I see it all the time of people who basically think that if they get enough career success, then their relationships will take care of themselves. And of course they won't. The biggest problem that people have who are quite successful in life is that they have an enormous number of deal friends, but almost no real friends. And everybody listening to us knows the difference between real friends and deal friends. And so what I wind up doing in this book is talking about what the difference is and how people at any stage in life, at 25 or 45 or even 65, can start building a roster of real friends so they can have the satisfaction that they deserve later in life.
The tricky thing there is if you are thinking, I'm going to optimize my time for success, I'm going to get the most out of every moment, you write in the book, just hanging out with a buddy may not at any given moment feel like the optimal use of time. So it's going to be put off infinitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that I find is that, you know, real success addicts, workaholic people, they tend to prioritize the 14th hour of work over the first hour with their families even. I mean, it's interesting. I was having a conversation over the course of writing the book with a very successful woman in New York City, a financier, a you know, titan on Wall Street who's made an enormous amount of money. And she's talking about all the things that are going wrong in her life that, you know, she feels her skills starting to decline, but she doesn't have relationships very close with her adult children. Her marriage is kind of on the rocks. And I said, well, you're already telling me what you need to do. You need to step back from work and repair these relationships. Why don't you do that? She said, I guess I'd prefer to be special than happy. In other words, she was making a decision that to say that she would, you know, anybody can hang out with their family, but not everybody can run this enormous firm. And she had been making an affirmative decision. This is what all kinds of addicts do. We do this all the time. It's a bad trade.
We're talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Bennett is with us in Madison. Bennett, hi.
Hi, yeah. I think that the way this was introduced was a little misleading. And I want to say that just because I agree with the principles that, you know, being a workaholic is not conductive to, you know, gaining happiness throughout life. But I think that as much as you can control your mindset surrounding, you know, what defines your happiness, success can be a healthy contribution to that. And you don't really have to, like, look at a peak in your career as a peak in your career. You know, you're the one who decides when you've peaked and when you want to, you know, utilize new skills to maybe go a different route with your career or what you define as success.
And Bennett, can I ask, if it's not too personal, how old are you?
I'm 24.
Okay. So you're looking at this from the low end. I love that. Thanks a lot for calling in, Bennett, at 800-642-1234. Arthur, what do you think? We can,
well,
as long as we define
insight.
Our peaks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, Bennett's got a good insight. And in point of fact, what's happening through Bennett's 20s, going in 20s and even 30s is an increase in what's called fluid intelligence. You get better and better at what you do. You can work harder and get a big return from it. That fluid intelligence from the ability to solve problems, usually to answer the questions that other people pose to you, that tends to start decreasing in your late 30s all the way through your 40s. But there's another kind of success that's behind it called your crystallized intelligence, your wisdom, your ability to not answer somebody else's questions, but to figure out what the right questions are, to build teams of people, to teach, to mentor. This gets incredibly strong as you go through your 50s and 60s and stays high in your 70s and 80s. What people don't do is they don't actually craft their life. They want to stay on that first curve because they were good at it, and they kind of rail against the world. They do what Dylan Thomas called rage against the dying of the light. And it's an exercise in futility. You got to be willing to change. That's one of the great secrets of happy people as they age.
Bennett, thanks for that call. Yeah, Arthur, chapter one in your book was about this inevitable decline and what you mentioned, that fluid intelligence. It was really kind of depressing. So I'm glad I kept reading to chapter two, this other kind of intelligence, that wisdom. How do we intentionally shift gears, though?
Well, to begin with, you got to know that second curve exists. A lot of people think that they get one curve. And for the longest time, psychologists talked about different kinds of genius, the early kind and the late kind. The early kind was, you know, sort of your Elon Musk type of genius, and everybody has it. This is not just about rich and famous people or people who are classified as geniuses as kids. Everybody has the capacity to work hard and to innovate and make something with their life. The second genius type that they talked about was kind of the Dalai Lama type of genius. You know, the wisdom, the people, the great sage, call it the David McCullough genius if you want. You know, the people who are able to take complex ideas and boil them down and explain them to others. Well, what we found out much more recently is everybody has both. The key thing is that you get one early and one late. And so the first thing that people need to keep in mind is that they have to trust that they have the second curve. But you can't get on the second curve until you get off the first curve. And that means you have to have confidence that it exists. You have to have the love of other people in your life so that as you start making changes, you don't feel like there's nothing out there for you. And this is one of the things that I talk about. I give basically step-by-step instructions in the book about how to go from one curve to the other.
We're talking with Arthur Brooks, professor of public leadership and management at Harvard. We're talking about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you reinvent yourself, shift gears in your career, change your definition of success and happiness at some point? Or do you have questions for our guest about his work in this book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with author, columnist, and professor Arthur Brooks about his new book, From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Has the definition of success changed for you over the course of your life, of your career? How about happiness? Can the two go together or do they run into each other? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Kevin is with us in Appleton. Kevin, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kevin?
Well, you know, I think that, I've been working in the dairy industry for 32 years, kind of middle management jobs, always trying to get more and more or better, the next step up, impress management, you know, and I put my family on the back burner. I went back to school, you know, I did stuff, and I kind of put my family on the back burner for a lot of years, and now I realize I should have done that. I mean, they're where my happiness is.
Kevin, are you taking a second shot here and spending that time, spending that effort on your family now?
Yeah, I am actually, but unfortunately my arthritis and stuff prevents me from doing a lot of things I'd like to do.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Good luck to you in making this transition now. Arthur, what do you hear in Kevin's story there?
I think Kevin has actually got a lot. He's saying a lot of things that are absolutely right. But more importantly, I think it's incredibly encouraging because he actually recognized what the problem is. Most people, they feel a malaise. They feel a kind of a loneliness who after they've been very successful for a long time and not paying adequate attention to the root systems, the real friendships and the family life that they need. Kevin figured it out, actually. And the result is I strongly suspect that he's going to have a lot of happy years ahead of him. one of the things that I talk to a lot of, to people who are making this transition to being happier as they age, is there's a number of ways to increase the, let's just say that, to bring up the temperature on the family relationships and to actually create these kind of real friendships. And, you know, I've looked into the there's a large academic literature that talks about, you know, the best ways to do these things. Believe it or not, social psychologists have been talking about this for many, many years. And so through interviews and actually looking at the social psychological literature, I talk about the fastest way to do actually just that. But the first step, as Kevin suggests, is recognizing that you don't always make the right decisions. Now, the good news is you can always get on the right train. You can do it when you're 25. You can do it when you're 45. You can do it when you're 65. The key thing is actually doing it, repairing your relationships and growing in love. The happiest people are thinking about their faith and their family life and their friendship. And to the extent that they're really thinking about their work, which is important, is to earn their success, lift other people up, and to serve people who need them.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. A big point you make in the book, Arthur, is people need to know a change is coming. Some kind of decline in one set of skills is probably going to be on the way. And you look at faith traditions around the world and talk about the idea of meditating on the fact that, hey, someday we're going to not do this anymore and people might forget about us. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's absolutely right. One of the reasons that a lot of people are unwilling to let the past go is because they're afraid. You know, fear is terrible. When I talk about love, I talk about love all the way through the book, because the truth is, it as a, you know, I'm a professor teaching classes of happiness here in Harvard. And if you can boil down all the things that I teach at the Harvard Business School, is that happiness is love. Full stop, basically. And I've got a ton of data to show that. The problem is that the opposite of love, the thing that crowds out love, is fear. People often think that the opposite of love is hatred. It's not. Hatred is downstream from fear. Anytime I find somebody who's lonely, find somebody who's having trouble finding love in their life, the first thing that I will start to investigate is the sources of their fear. And when we talk about these new stages of life, people are horribly afraid to actually lean into the weaknesses that they have, the strengths that they're actually starting to decline, so they can find the new strengths in their life. That's what the book is called, From Strength to Strength. So the one thing I recommend is that people meditate on the source of their fear. I was talking to my students at Harvard today about the fear of failure. I mean, so many of my students are deeply afraid of failing professionally, failing academically. And so the assignment that I give them is to meditate on what's the worst that can actually happen, to make it less scary, more ordinary, to have it become part of a, you know, part of your familiarity. It's most likely not going to happen, but in certain cases, like your own death, there's nothing that you can do about it. You might as well get used to it. And you absolutely can. The Buddhists have been doing this for a couple thousand years, and we can do it too.
Talking to Arthur Brooks about his new book. It is called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Let's go back to your calls. Ronnie is with us in Cameron. Ronnie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I feel like in the first half, I did a fairly good job raising kids and finding my own satisfaction through teaching and managing Furman Fleet stores. But now I'm in the second half, and I'm finding I'm retired. I want to go back into production agriculture. I'm doing that, working a couple different jobs. But what I'm also finding is that I'm finding some resistance from my husband, who thinks that I'm not going to have enough saved up for retirement and this and that. And it's caused some conflict. And so I think having, you know, if you have a significant other, having both people agreeing with what the plan should be. And it does create some challenges. So I'd like to know what your guest has to say.
Ronnie, good luck with your new career. Arthur, what do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie. And good for you. I like to hear it, because you're jumping onto your second curve with both feet. One of the things that I recommend, so that people can be on the same page, you know, people who love each other, marriages, for example, that can really function as people change, is to be thinking about the fact that you're going to change and you should change together. Another way of thinking about this is to say, look, we have a 401k for our retirement, but we need a happiness 401k as well. And to make to set up ideas together, to plan out what we're going to do, so that together we can become happier people, and to make the investments that we actually need. What are the investments in our children? What are the investments in our friend group? What are the investments that we're going to make in each other's professional life so that we can go from strength to strength? And when we see each other as fundamentally invested in each other's happiness, which, by the way, the one thing that all happy married couples have in common is they're working for each other's happiness. The best way to do that that I've ever seen is to say, okay, what are the things that we need? What are the deposits that we need to put in our 401k together? And how are we going to do it?
Thanks for that call. Good luck negotiating that, Ronnie. Arthur, I wanted to talk to you about faith and spirituality. You talk in the book about your own Catholic faith. You also learn teachings from religions from India and China. What do you think about the role of faith and spirituality in negotiating this big change later in life?
Well, the role of faith can't be, it shouldn't be underestimated at any stage of life, actually. Now, this does not necessarily mean my faith. One of the things that I find and that I teach to my students is that the habits of the happiest people at every age, but especially as people get older, are basically fourfold. They're, as I mentioned before, faith, family, friendship, and work that serves other people. And when I say faith, I mean faith or even a non-religious tradition that kind of zooms out on life. And this is the key thing to keep in mind. One of the things that unhappy people have in common is they're very obsessed with the humdrum details of an ordinary life. My job, my car, my money, my friends, my this, that, and the other thing. And it's like watching the same boring television show over and over again. You're obsessed with it, but it can't really hold your interest in a meaningful, happy way. The great thing about studying the Stoic philosophers or developing a meditation practice or like me, you know, seriously practicing your Christian faith, is what that does is it allows you to zoom out on life to see the adventure that actually is life in the transcendent. And everybody deserves to have that kind of adventure.
In our last minute or so, Arthur, can you leave people with maybe a first step to try to shift this mindset away from success and the importance of work to all the other stuff?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing that I find about what all of the successful people have in common is that they have all the things and people and the transcendent in order in their lives. And so basically, this is the key thing to keep in mind. The world's formula for your happiness is all wrong. The world's formula is use people, love things, and worship yourself. And that's wrong. The real formula sounds like that. And so that's why the false formula kind of sounds right. The real formula is use things, love people, and worship the divine. If you follow that formula, you're going to be just fine.
Arthur, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Arthur Brooks, professor of leadership and management at Harvard University. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. Still time to share your story. If you are reinventing yourself in your career or figure out what the next step is right now, email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.